At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given to you at that time. If you do need assistance during the call today, you may press star and then zero, and an operator will assist you offline. And as a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Emily James. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Cynthia. Welcome to today's press call to discuss the NCAA Division I Committee on Infractions decision regarding Syracuse University. As members of the media, you should have received a link to both the press release and public decision, which contains the details of this case. The information can also be found on ncaa.org. The Committee of Infractions is an independent group comprised of representatives across the NCAA membership and the public. The members who reviewed this case include Michael Adams, President Emeritus of the University of Georgia, Britton Banowski, Chief Hearing Officer and Commissioner of this Conference USA, Thomas Hill, Senior Vice President for Student Affairs, Iowa State University, Roscoe C. Howard, Jr. Attorney, Phil Maturi, former University of Minnesota Athletics Director, and Greg Sankey, Chair of the D1 Committee on Infractions and Executive Associate Commissioner and Chief Operating Officer for the SEC. Brian Banowski will now discuss the findings and decisions of the Infractions Committee. Following his opening comments, he will take questions.
Okay, thank you, Emily, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm sorry I have a bit of a cold, so I hope you can bear with me as we work through this. Most on the call probably have not had a chance to read and review the full report, but it does detail the entire scope of the case, including both a factual discussion and an analysis section. And so I want everyone to know the report speaks for itself, and most of your questions can be answered by simply reading the report. It's important to note at the outset that there were few facts in dispute, and most of the allegations were also not disputed, with some exception, obviously. This case is characterized as level one, meaning it involves a severe breach of conduct. That is to say, there were several violations that seriously undermine or threaten the integrity of the collegiate model for athletics. Because the case had some violations that occurred prior to the recent penalty reform, the institution was entitled to application of the less severe penalty structure. The case spans a considerable length of time and primarily involves the sport of men's basketball. Key findings in the case include impermissible payments to student athletes by a booster involved with AAU basketball from an AAU bank account, ongoing failure to adhere to the university's written drug testing policies, and multiple episodes of academic misconduct and academic fraud committed by men's basketball staff members, as well as the provision of impermissible academic extra benefits, in most instances designed to ensure that the student athletes remained eligible to compete for the basketball team. In addition, the panel concluded that the head men's basketball coach failed to promote an atmosphere of compliance and failed to monitor the activities of the individuals in his program. Under Bylaw 11-121, a head coach is presumed to be aware of the violations and responsible for the violations committed by those he supervises. Finally, the committee found that over the course of a 10-year period, the institution failed to exercise control and monitor the conduct and administration of its athletics program. We were fortunate to have on the panel Dr. Michael Adams, President Emeritus from the University of Georgia, as well as Dr. Thomas Hill, Vice President for Academic Services from Iowa State University, and Joel Maturi. Each brought decades of experience on campus and a solid perspective on the issues in this case, which really go to the core values of the NCAA and higher education. As is outlined in more detail in the report, the penalties include 5 years of probation from March 6, 2015 through March 5, 2020. Vacation of all wins in which ineligible men's basketball student athletes played in 2004-05, 5-6, 6-7, 10-11, and 11-12, and ineligible football students played in 04 through 06 and 07. The public decision contains additional details about the vacation of lands. There are fines, including a requirement that the university return to the NCAA all funds it received from its appearances in the 2011, 12, and 13 NCAA men's basketball tournament, a suspension of the head basketball coach from the first nine conference games of 2015-16, a reduction of men's basketball scholarships by three in each of the following years, 15-16, 16-17, 17-18, and 18-19, reduction in the number of permissible off-campus recruiters from four to two during the period June 1, 2015 through May 31, 2017. And then the committee and the panel also noted and accepted the school's self-imposed postseason ban for the 2014-15 season. One more point to share. The investigations in this case went on for an extreme and excessive period of time. I think there's a timeline actually available for those who want to see it. And the panel noted this fact, and hopefully this case will trigger a process reform to require more timely resolution of cases in the future. That concludes my comments. And I would again encourage those interested to carefully read the entire report, as most of the answers to your questions are contained in it. Emily, I guess I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Britton. Cynthia, can you please explain how reporters can indicate they would like to ask questions?
Certainly, and ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your touch-tone phone. You will hear a tone indicating that you have been placed in queue, and you may remove yourself from queue by pressing the pound key. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. And once again, for any questions or comments, press star and then one. And our first question will come from the line of Dennis Dodd with CBSSports.com. Your line is open.
Thank you. I want to make sure you guys can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
Well, I can hear you, Dennis.
Okay, Britton, could you speak to the Syracuse AD's assertion, I guess at the hearing, that the school's own written drug policy was, quote, too confusing, close quote, to follow? And was that a reason Syracuse challenged some of the drug test allegations later on? And I have a follow-up, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Relative to drug testing, as you know, there's no requirement that institutions have a drug testing policy. But if they do, they are required to follow it. And in this case, there was a policy, a written policy that required action when student-athletes test positive. And numerous student-athletes tested positive on numerous occasions without being withheld from competition. So the written policy was simply not followed. And I think the panel felt like that if there is a written policy, the very purpose of a written policy is to create some level of clarity.
I have a follow-up as well. I understand. I think you used the old penalty structure. I think you mentioned that in this case. Mm-hmm. But in the new structure, in this case, would the head coach have been eligible for that one-year suspension that the coach was being held to in the new structure?
The answer is I believe so. We're 18 months into the new reformed processes, and for the most part, they seem to be working. The penalties in the new system are very severe, and I think that was intended by the NCAA Board of Directors when they adopted it. An important consideration is when facts in a case predate the reform, the institution's not subject to the more severe penalties. But had that not been the case, this is a level one case, serious breach, aggravated circumstances, so you'd be looking at, a minimum of 6 years probation, minimum of 2 years postseason ban, a minimum of 25% scholarship cuts, which could go much more, and I think it's a minimum of 50% of a season in terms of suspension. So I think everyone needs to just be noting that we're moving into kind of a new place relative to the severity of penalties going forward.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Pat Ford with Yahoo Sports. Your line is open.
Hi, Britton. I was just wondering, in glancing at the report, you said that the drug testing policy was failed to be adhered to starting in 2001. There's no games vacated until 2004-05. Can you explain why games were not vacated earlier than that?
I mean, there wasn't any allegation in the case at all that there was ineligibility prior to, I think, 2004. In fact, I think even there was a statute of limitations agreement between the staff and the university that that triggered off of May 2003.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Andy Katz with ESPN. The line is open.
Thank you. Britton, I want to get to the self-imposed postseason ban that Syracuse used, and obviously schools have tried this in the past, even one in your conference, Southern Miss, has done it already for this season. What is the committee's reaction when they get word that there is a self-imposed ban prior to the announcement of any sanctions, and then as a dovetail follow-up to that, what is your personal reaction as to how necessary that is to penalize mid-year students that are not even involved in the case, rather than starting it out fresh the following fall, as all these penalties are in terms of the suspension for ban and all that kind of stuff. It all starts next year. If you could answer both of those, please.
Yeah, so, you know, if an institution, through its responsibility to investigate violations on their campus, wants to self-impose a penalty, there's nothing to prevent that from happening. And so, as you know, in previous cases, even in the Miami case, it was a long, protracted investigation and case. I mean, there were two postseason bans self-imposed in Miami on the football program. It becomes more problematic when it's in the middle of a football season or a middle of a basketball season, and it also obviously becomes more problematic post-hearing. But ultimately, it's the university's call if they want to do that.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Brian Sharp with Democrat and Chronicle. Your line is open.
Yes, in the report it says that the institution identified 24 basketball victories, 11 football victories, but if I'm reading this correctly, it sounds like the panel expected that there would be more and it's directed them to come back to the report in 45 days. Can you give any indication either precisely how many victories for both that you're expecting to be vacated, or at least some indication on how much you expect those to increase, where we expect them to end?
I think we just want to make sure we get it right, and I think it's more or less a clerical matter that the university and the staff have to get together and make sure the math is done correctly, up or down.
We have a question from the line of Paul Newberry with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thank you. Just to clarify again, you said that this certainly the coach would have been probably facing at least a half-season ban under the new guidelines. And was the 9-game, I'm not clear on the old rules, is that the maximum that he could get under the old standard?
In the current system, there really aren't brackets around it. In the new system going forward, there are more prescribed penalties that in cases that are level one severe and with aggravation are, you know, the panel will be required to impose. Going forward, it's going to be more prescribed than it is right now.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Chris Carlson with Syracuse Post-Standard. Your line is open.
Britton, the university has kind of come out and disputed Jim Boeheim's responsibility for a violation. How do you factually support the contention that he's, you know, personally responsible for many of them?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, the rule is pretty clear that a head coach has a duty to monitor the activities of those in the program and is also presumed to be accountable for their violations. And the presumption in the case was not effectively rebutted at all. I mean, in fact, the coach hired the director of basketball operations to improve the academic performance of the players, and he did it by logging into their email accounts, exchanging communication with professors about what the student needs to do, and then in concert with the basketball receptionist, assisted in the preparation of coursework for the players. So in this case, the panel felt the head coach should be responsible for the people who report directly to him, most certainly.
Thank you. Our next question comes to mind of Dana O'Neill with ESPN.com. Your line is open.
Britton, that was almost essentially my question, because I just wanted to clarify. You said that most of the allegations were not disputed, but in the report it also says that Jim Boeheim did, in fact, dispute that he should be held accountable, correct?
Yeah, that's an exception. There was the controversy over that, as well as whether the institution should be held accountable for a lack of institutional control.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is a follow-up from Andy Katz with ESPN. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Britton, I just want to make clear, what kind of effect did Syracuse's postseason ban have on the penalties?
I mean, we noted it and accepted it. That's it.
What were the chances, if I can follow up real quickly, had they not done that, that you would have imposed a postseason ban for next season?
You know, I don't want to speculate about that, Andy.
Thank you. Our next question comes from a follow-up from Pat Ford with Yahoo Sports. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Britton, you said that a statute of limitations was reached, agreement reached between staff and university for May 2003. What constitutes staff? Is that NCAA enforcement staff or committee on infractions? Who is the staff in question?
You know, I asked that question in an email this morning, and so because I thought it might be asked on this call. And so the enforcement staff in its reply indicated that the parties agreed the pertinent date is May 4, 2003.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Bill Carey with Time Warner Cable. Your line is open.
Yes, sir. The question is, again, related to Coach Boeheim. He is the one name that stretches throughout this investigation. Just how important should the NCAA treat the matter of coaches not making sure that the rules are being followed?
I mean, it's very serious. It's a rule that's been around for a while that holds head coaches responsible in all sports for the violations that take place in their program. And it's not enough to say I thought they knew the rules and thought they were following the rules. There's a higher level of responsibility that attaches to the head coach because ultimately he or she is responsible.
Thank you. We have a follow-up from the line of Brian Sharp with Democratic Chronicle. Your line is open.
I just wanted to follow up on one of your opening remarks. You talked about extreme and excessive period of the investigation and hope that it triggers some resolution or reforms to address these matters more timely. Can you speak a little bit more to that? How, I guess, what contributed to the extreme and excessive period and how you could see that being rectified going forward?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll comment a little bit. I mean, from my perspective, having kind of been on the membership side of the NCAA for quite a while, I think it's really harmful for these processes to go on too long. I think the reputation of the university gets unnecessarily put out there in the public pre-hearing, and so I'm a big advocate for figuring out a way to expedite these things and move them along and do it in a way that's more thoughtful from a timing perspective. In this case, I think, you know, the NCAA enforcement staff has to take some responsibility here. They ultimately, you know, were managing an investigation on their side. I think the processing of some of the academic misconduct issues on campus obviously added to the delay. Certainly they weren't expedited and it took some time. And even in the last couple of months, I mean, issues were being appealed to the NCAA governance groups on interpretive issues. And so You know, the bottom line is it's unacceptable, I think, for our membership to have cases that drag on this long.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Tim Ruffinen with Time Warner News. Please go ahead.
Mr. Benowski, I was calling to in regards to how many wins are being docked from Coach Boeheim. Do you guys have a number on that?
We've encouraged the staff of the NCAA and the staff of the university to get together and make sure they do the math well. So I really don't have a number right now.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Jake New with Inside Higher Ed. Your line is open.
Thanks. So I guess what I'm asking is, there's been sort of this broader effort, it seems, to crack down on academic fraud. We keep hearing some numbers being thrown out regarding to how many schools are being investigated. And you mentioned this going, this case going kind of to the core value of the NCAA. So I'm wondering, how do you and the NCAA kind of view this in relation to this broader effort? And is that going anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the elements of this case was NCAA decision to defer to institutions because the academy is really a better place to have matters of academic fraud resolved. And so, you know, that certainly took place in this case. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that you can't have violations in terms of providing academic extra benefits and support that go clearly beyond what the other students on campus get. So I think step one is to be deferential to the university systems and processes. But ultimately, if you have a situation where the desire to achieve success on the basketball court overrides the academic integrity, yeah, it really demonstrated clearly misplaced priorities. And so, you know, that's where the NCAA processes come in.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of John Solomon with CBSSports.com. Your line is open.
Hey, Britton, that was sort of my question as well about the academic integrity determination. But I know there's been some efforts to sort of rewrite what the NCAA can do in terms of academic fraud issues. Have committee members, have they talked about sort of where you all may stand on this moving forward?
You know, the committee is one place for that conversation, but really it's a conversation for the broader membership in all of higher education. I mean, academic misconduct is not something that's isolated to student athletes and sports. It's across the board. And so I think you'll see over the course of the next several months and even longer, a more focused dialogue about where the lines are drawn here and what expectations are placed on the NCAA enforcement program to pursue these matters.
Thank you. Our final question comes from the line of Paul Newberry with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yeah, just to follow up to my earlier question regarding the suspension for Coach Boeheim, why did the committee settle on 9 games, and was there any thought of a longer suspension?
The committee discussed it, an appropriate penalty, and did some review of prior cases in terms of the discussion, but ultimately just felt like 9 games was the right place. It actually represents 50% of the conference season. I think the conference season is an 18-game season, and the group just felt like that was the right place to be.
Thank you. And speakers, I'd like to turn it back over to you for any closing comments.
I don't have any.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes our comments. A recording of this teleconference will be available in the near future on the NCAA website at ncaa.org.